Today on Dolby Creator Talks, we welcome legendary composer Hans Zimmer. As you probably know, Hans has scored countless classic films over his illustrious career, and he continues to innovate. His score for Dune Part 2 is one of his best to date. Before we jump into the interview, I wanted to mention that this is actually our second conversation about Dune Part 2 this week. Be sure to check out our interview with cinematographer Greg Fraser, which we posted just a couple of days ago. But for now, I'd like to hand things over to our regular guest host, music journalist John Burlingame, for his interview with composer Hans Zimmer.
Our guest today truly needs no introduction. His music has enhanced dozens of our favorite films, from Rain Man and The Lion King to Gladiator, The Dark Knight, and Inception. He won the Oscar for his score for the first chapter of Dune, and happily for us, he has returned to the desert planet of Arrakis for the next chapter, Dune Part 2. Welcome, Hans Zimmer.
Happily for you, happily for me, I got to return to the wonderful world of Denis Villeneuve, the wonderful world of Dune.
So let me start by asking you briefly about your earlier experience. You had done Blade Runner 2 with Denis, your director. Did he come to you with Dune right after that?
We were standing on the pavement at Warner Brothers waiting for a car. And he very quietly said to me, had I ever heard of a book called Dune? And I turned into one of those little dogs that get super hyper excited, and I was jumping up and down and yapping. And I think I scared Denis a little bit with my reaction, but he understood that this meant a tremendous amount to me. And it meant a tremendous amount to me as a teenager. And the same with him. And I think something, as a dichotomy that happens very rarely happens to both of us, where while we were making the film, while we were working on the film, we embraced it with the recklessness and the spontaneity and the love and passion that only a teenager can embrace something like that. It transported us back to absolutely who we were at that point in time. But the other half of us, the other part of us, was the seasoned filmmakers, the people who knew how to actually do this, the people who could go to the film studio and go, I know this is going to cost a lot of money. I know it's a gamble, but we have proven ourselves. We can probably pull this off, even though secretly, behind closed doors, we were going, oh my God, how are we going to do this?
Well, not only did you do it, but of course, Dune won multiple Academy Awards, including one for your score, which of course, not only deserved it, but I thought stretched you in perhaps ways that you hadn't really explored before musically.
Actually, I think it's the other way. Whereby these were the things which probably had been on my mind ever since I read the book. It's just I never had the opportunity to try them. I mean, you know, Laura Kotler's Banshee Veil, you know, the idea of doing a sci-fi movie, and this is the precocious 13-year-old talking to you right now. I could never understand why in a science fiction movie, you know, I loved them all, and but why we would hear, a sort of a European orchestral sound? Why the strings? Why the French horns? You know, everything else looked futuristic. Everything else was different, except the music still stuck to the rules of the Romantic period. And by the way, I'm not criticizing it. I mean, you know, there's nothing I love more than Alien or Star Wars. You know, they're phenomenal things. But I saw my duty very much as going beyond that. And you know, look, I am a huge defender of the orchestra. I mean, I think if we lose the orchestra, we will lose vast amounts of what makes us human. But in this case, I wanted to go and write a score which was really centered around these unbelievable virtuoso musicians that I have the privilege to work with.
Do you see Part 2 as an extension of what you had already written in Dune Part 1, or did you really have to think about and start again and create a great deal of new material?
The first thing you hear in part one was an experiment where, you know, music and sounds, it's very difficult to explain that in words. So the voice you hear at the very beginning of the film was something I had tried to explain to Denis of how to do, and then I gave up trying to explain how to do it, and I just did it and sent it to him, and he had the great idea that this would be a great way to opening. So there is a direct line between that very first sound you hear and the themes we've developed and the sounds we developed. There's a lot of experimentation. There's a lot of building of instruments. There's a lot of driving software writers quite crazy by going, no, I need 5 resonators. You know, I know you don't understand why I need 5 resonators, but trust me on this. And it doesn't matter if you understand what a resonator is or not. You know, just trust me on this too. So the movie, the first movie ends a second before where the second one starts. So of course I am doing, I know from the first note where I want the last note to end. But what I kept doing is, so the first note, we finished the first movie and I kept on writing. And Denis actually phoned me up and said, you know something, you might not have realized this, but the movie has opened. It is in cinemas. And I'm going, no, I know, but I have high hopes that we will get the money to do the second half. And I have, and I think my job is partly to inspire you. So the theme, which is now very much the main theme of this movie, it first makes its appearance as a sort of a love theme, but then at the end of the movie, it sums up everything. That was written in that period between the two movies. And then to test drive it in a funny sort of way, I was touring Europe. You know, I was playing arenas, 20,000 people a night. And I would start the show off by having Laura Kotler, who's our great voice in the movie, just stand there by herself on the stage for 4 minutes and sing this piece that nobody knew. You know, and they must have all been going, what's all this about? I thought we were going to go and see this big show with, you know, orchestra and lights and da-da-da, you know, whatever, you know, the full circus, and all you get is one girl singing for 4 minutes. But then I thought, when this movie comes along, maybe there's a residue, there's some emotional residue left from those performances, and people would go, oh, this feels like something I felt before. I can't quite put my hand on it, my finger on it, but there is a connection.
Do you think of that piece as the love theme for Paul and Chani?
I think of it as the love theme for Paul and Chani, if I want to. But it really is. It becomes everything at the end of the movie. It becomes, you know, the anti love theme in a sort of, or maybe it's the most profound love theme at that point. But it's just the one that wraps up the whole movie. And one of the things which I love about it is that it. Because I love the musicians who play in this film. I mean, truly adore them. That it goes from Pedro on his duduk to, I think it goes to Guthrie on his guitar, Guthrie Govan, the world's greatest guitarist. onto Loire singing it, Tina playing it on her cello. So at the end of it, what we do is what, you know, I think what, which is the right thing to do, is since these musicians are the last actors that get cast on a movie, I mean, they are actors because their performance, especially if it's not an orchestral score, but a score entirely done by virtuosos, you know, with a point of view, you know, with a tone of their own, it's very important to recognize them as actors. So it ends with, you know, my little troupe of actors, you know, shining and becoming the solos and playing you out in the appropriate way.
Do you think of this as a darker score than the first one? There's so much that's happening here. The Harkonnens, the Emperor, even the Bene Gesserit, we discover is a little bit more diabolical than perhaps that we had thought. And they're all scheming to control Arrakis. So did the score have to be somewhat darker in tone?
No, but the score moves towards that. You know, what the score does, it follows, or I follow very closely Zendaya, Chani, and I follow Timothy very closely. So as his character develops, you know, as his character turns darker, you know, I turn darker. As she becomes more pragmatic, heroic, intelligent, intellectual, you know, she's the intellectual, you know, she's the fearless one. She's the one who recognizes that, you know, the whole idea of the Messiah could just all be a setup. You know, nonetheless, she loves him. Nonetheless, I think this movie truly ends in the most tragic of ways, you know? So it's not so much, you know, the darkness, sure, the darkness exists, but really, really at the end of the day, and that's why that theme comes back, which you at first think of as a love theme, and really as it's a mournful theme. It's a theme that speaks of loneliness. You know, that I don't know. It's an immensely human theme because, you know, and partly how Pedro plays it. I mean, you know, when you meet Pedro Eustache, you realize that you've just met a man who has an enormous heart, and he can't help but expose that heart in his playing. So there's that, you know, and pain and love and all these things are within every note.
It's a wonderful theme because I remember thinking at first, it's tender yet melancholy. You know, it's not a traditional love theme in that sense. And it almost sort of presages what's going to happen in the film in a way.
There could have been two ways of approaching it. I could have written a more traditional love theme, you know, and then, you know, then turned that on its head and, but I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to stay honest with the audience and go, you know, what you see at this moment, which is two young people in love, you know, but love is complicated. Love,
especially here.
Yeah, absolutely. So So I was more interested in there's a strange thing that I think that happens when two people are in love. They become more aware of how lonely they can be if they're not in love, you know? And so I think the nostalgia or the loneliness that is in that thing, it's not so much that it tells you where the story is going. It just tells you the way it is, you know? These are two star-crossed lovers.
You know, the soundscape of the film in general, in the most general sense, is fascinating to me because most of the time you don't really know what you're listening to. You can't identify, with rare exceptions, what the individual instruments are that you're utilizing. And I wonder how complicated a process that was. You're not really disguising things. You're more or less inventing new sounds, aren't you?
No, we invented new instruments. We started with inventing new instruments. We started to spend hours... Even the synthesizers we used, you know, and synthesizers are there to invent new sounds, right? We would still go and badger our amazing software writer in Berlin, Urs Heckmann. You know, no, Urs, you don't understand. I need 5 comb filters and 5 resonators. You know, and you know he's going, why do you need that? You know, because I got something in my head. You know, we have to do it, and. And no, not everything you hear it is what you think you hear. You know, I mean, there was that incident early on the first movie where we were doing a Q&A in New York after a screening, and somebody asked me about the bagpipes, and I'm going, oh, no, that's you don't hear the that's not bagpipes. That's Guthrie Govan playing the guitar. And Denis looks at me, and he goes, you mean to tell me that my beautiful bagpipe is not a bagpipe? I'm going, did I forget to tell him? I said, well, yes. You know, and we carry on with the Q&A, and this carries on for a while. And he stops the Q&A, and he just looks at me. He goes, is there anything else you need to tell me? You know, so very often what you hear is not what you It's not but we're not imitating sounds. I mean, Tina with her electric cello, you know. So the only thing that is pure, and even that is slightly, obviously it's that modified when you hear the voice of the sadhuka at the beginning of the movie. But, you know, the female voices, you know, which are Loire and Lisa Gerard and people like that, even those are, Loire is the one who gets away with being the purest, but Loire is right at the edge of losing her voice for good. You know, she just you know, she's fearless and she just decided she was going to throw herself completely into this. And you know, and it's interesting because she had to teach somebody else how to do that and. Realize the responsibility because you can rupture your vocal cords.
Talk a little bit more about the voices here. I mean, I remember talking with you quite a lot about the voices in the first film. I sensed that in the second film, we're hearing sort of less vocal material, less choral material, unless it's there and maybe a little farther back in the mix.
Actually, we hear more of it because we actually... There is a real choir in it. Happens only a couple of times. But you hear more vocal material, and it is further back in the mix, except that there are a couple of moments, only two, I believe, where we actually let Loire do the banshee, you know, her banshee call.
Yes, and it sounds great.
You know, when Paul finally stands up on the sandworm, you know, it's like such a triumphant moment. And I think there is something good about maintaining this idea that the strength of everything in this film comes from the women in one way or the other, for good or for bad, right? And so the center of everything is always, you know, it's always the female voice.
We talked to cinematographer Greg Fraser earlier today, and he specifically cited your score at the moment of writing the sandworm as what really makes that sequence work.
Well, I love that he said that, but he's completely wrong, because I say it's Craig Fraser who makes that work. Because he, you know, he shoots from a point of view, right? From our point of view. And he lets us be on the sandworm. And we get clobbered. We get hit by sand. And, you know, and you want to shut your eyes. And afterwards, you know, that you feel slightly, there's slightly grit in your eyes after you get through that scene. You know, and look, one of the things I love is, you know, I mean, Craig isn't just any DP. He has a career as an artist, you know, still photographer, you know, and I love what he does with Josh Brolin, you know, where Josh is really a poet. And Josh and I wrote a song together.
We need to talk about that.
Well, and it was a bit weird because I and the family and I the kids, we went Antarctica. And Josh is going, we need a song. We need to write a song together about, you know, sand, heat, dunes, you know, da da da. And I'm, you know, I am literally surrounded by penguins, etc. And I'm sending him photos of icebergs, you know, and stuff like that. And he's going, he finally went, come on, get serious. We're shooting the scene, you know. So, you know, write the song already.
So what did the song need to say? Does that, again, because we're talking about Josh's character of Gurney, who I believe in the original novel actually does sing.
And we have three other songs, you know.
Well, how many songs did you write?
Well, I think we wrote four in total. And then there are three in the first one. They just didn't make it into the movie, you know.
The one in Dune 2 was new.
The one in Dune 2 was new, and it's very specific what it does. It shows you a reckless side of the character. It shows you, you know, this man has become a pirate and he's singing, you know, and it's that. So it's, and he's playing the balisette.
Which is an instrument that I think Frank Herbert invented for the book, didn't he?
It doesn't exist. No, it doesn't exist. So guess what we did? We built one. So we built something that was playable. It's a simple thing, but every answer I give you, see in the light of being answered by a 13 or 14 year old, because that was the spirit, you know. And so when I say, you know, oh, we build a balisette. Of course we build a balisette, because that's what a 13 or 14-year-old would do, right?
Sure.
You know, you get the glue out and you get the wood and, you know, you get the drill and you get into trouble with your parents, you know, because you sewed off one of the table legs, you know.
This is an even longer film, which I suspect has at least as much music as the first film. So I'm always curious to know, over what period of time did you work on this? And did you work on this even while you were on tour in Europe?
You know, I'm not sure, because I don't think I ever stopped working on it, because I, even though I did other movies in between, you know, I kept going back to it, and I kept going back to it, or phoning people. You know, all right, here's one of the things. You know, we are very international. I mean, the band, and it is the band that plays the music on this. So,
is everyone in their own studio turning things in?
Yes, and then everybody comes into the studio at the end, you know. But, you know, like ideas or sounds or, you know, things are developed in everybody's studio. So there were a lot of people in Vienna. There were, you know, there's Lisa in Australia. There is, I think, Snow Owl, the bassist. I think he was in Tahiti, which is most annoying, you know. Well, Alejandro, what other time zones did we have? We had Europe, we had New York, we had Vienna, we had Australia. And that all seemed like a really good idea at the time, until it turned out that the only person who had to go and talk to everybody in different time zones was me, which meant there was never, there wasn't a lot of sleep. But you know, and I have Alejandro, my amazing sidekick on this project, sitting over there. I mean, we just worked on, I don't even know when we started working on it. To me, it feels like we never stopped between the first.
We were in the middle of tour, we were working on it.
Yeah, there you go. We were in the middle of the tour, we were working on it.
I also have to ask you, the sound, of course, in general in this movie is extraordinary. And so if you know that your movie is going to be released in Dolby Atmos, do you write differently or mix differently?
Interesting thing about Dolby Atmos was, you know, there was a learning curve for us. I mean, the first couple of movies we did in Dolby Atmos, I felt we didn't really know how to control, all the new toys. You know, it's like, so it all became a bit, but if on the first unit felt like we had finally mastered it. And then now the second one, so this is not me speaking, but it has other dubbing engineers and other musicians and other people who've seen it, who think that this might be one of the finest, you know, mixes that they've ever heard. There's nothing more wonderful than when the lights go down, you're sitting among strangers, and you don't know what you're going to get to feel. You don't know what you're going to get to experience. But wow, it's an experience, and it's great and grand and beautiful, and the picture quality is getting better, and the sound quality is better, and you know, what is immersive becomes an extreme experience.
We have to wrap in a minute, but I have to ask you, because there are so many hints dropped in Dune 2 about what might happen next. Are you ready to go to work on Dune Messiah?
I don't see why not. I just remember Denis walking wordlessly into the room and just putting the book on my keyboard. And I don't know, maybe he just wanted me to, maybe he just had an extra copy of the book. I don't know.
Well, I have to say, thank you so much, Hans, for spending some time with us today. It's an extraordinary job.
Thank you.
Great to see you again.
Lovely to see you. Be well, my friend.
You too.
Good to see you.
Many thanks to Hans for joining us on our podcast today. And thanks again to John for conducting yet another excellent interview. And an extra special thanks to our friends at Warner Brothers for helping us put this conversation together. Dune Part 2 is now in theaters in stunning Dolby Vision and Dolby Atmos. So if you can get a ticket to see the film at a Dolby Cinema, you will not regret it. You can find links to tickets, as always, in our show notes. As I mentioned up top, this is our second conversation this week regarding Dune Part 2. So be sure to check out our interview with cinematographer Greg Fraser in our podcast feed from just a few days ago. There are links to our show on all the major podcasting platforms, including the video version on YouTube, in our show notes. Or you can simply search for Dolby wherever you get your podcasts. Links will also be in our show notes. If you're curious to know more about the Dolby Institute, head on over to dolbyinstitute.com. There you'll find information about all of our programs. You can access the entire library of episodes of this podcast, and you can sign up for our mailing list. Until next time, this is Dolby Creator Talks. I'm your host, Glenn Kaiser. Our producer and editor is Michael Coleman. Our executive producers are Amanda Schneider and Jack Ferry, with additional editing by Matt Nixon. And our production coordinator is Karen Marroquin. Thank you for joining us.